This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio. Sitting in for Libby, here is Tasha Kiridan.
Good Thursday afternoon to you. Pleasure to be here. So much to talk about, including all the good stuff coming out of City Hall this week. Well, is it good or is it not? That's what we're going to ask our tune into the town panel. We're going to look at a motion to combat anti-Semitism, the speeding up of the LRT, which is, well overdue, the debate over e-scooters, hopping the curb and what can be done about that, as well as a luxury tax or a tax on luxury homes and Toronto's cooling policy in apartment buildings, something people have talked about for a very long time. In the back half of the show, we're going to turn to federal politics. Is the Conservative Party poised for a shakeup in 2026? Some say yes, with the defections to the Liberals that have taken place. So political strategist John McEtishan is going to join us to assess potential contenders in a potential leadership race. And at 12:45, we're going to have an in-depth conversation about Toronto's most complex fire. Fire Chief Jim Jessup is going to walk us through just what happened at the Thorncliffe Park blaze, what went wrong, what we've learned, and how it changes the rule book now for going forward and fighting these fires. That is all coming up today on Fight Back.
And now, it's time to tune into the town.
All right. Tuning into the town is what we're going to do. I got one person bravely here in studio with me, Rob Davis, former Toronto City Councillor and founder of Rob Davis & Associates. Thanks for coming in.
I'm not afraid of downtown.
And no least on the phones with us on, well, Google Meets anyway, John Burnside, City Councillor for Ward 16, as well as Mike Cole, Ward 8, Eglinton Lawrence. Welcome, everybody.
Oh, good afternoon.
Thank you. All right. So you know what, Mike? I'm going to start with you because you put forward a motion this week that passed to combat anti-Semitism in Toronto after the horrific attacks at Bondi Beach. And I would say the continued anti-Semitism that we've seen on our streets for the past 2 years since October 7th. So I'd like you to tell us a bit about what this motion is designed to do and how effective you think things are going to be if it's implemented.
Well, right now, Tasha, you know, we've got very weak provincial federal laws that deal with anti-Semitic hate. The police are on the ground. You know, we've spent $30 million in police overtime over the last couple of years trying to deal with these hostile demonstrations. And basically, you know, what happened at Bondi Beach is a pretty strong warning to us that we better up our game or else, God forbid, the same thing could happen here. So we just can't have the OPP and the RCMP sitting on the sidelines. We need them to work with the Toronto police to try and really send a strong message that we've got all hands on deck to try to prevent any future hostile activities, really foreign-inspired acts of terrorism. This is not a local Toronto issue. This has international dimensions to it, and it's not going to stop unless we really get on the ground with all levels of government pitching in and boots on the ground from the OPP and the RCMP to help our Toronto police.
Now, Rob, you're nodding. I mean, it's impossible to disagree that this is a good idea. My only question is, whenever you're talking about aligning three levels of government, you end up with delays, and we really don't need any delays. So how could we maybe streamline this? Do you think there's a willingness at those levels of government to step up?
I think so. And, you know, there's a model for this. We did this. I worked on it for a client with regards to auto theft. You know, the way in which the federal provincial governments, the provincial governments and municipalities got together at an auto theft summit 2 years ago. I mean, this is, I think, the model. And actually, Councillor Cole was there. He and I were there, along with a lot of other municipal leaders. So I think he's right. This anti-Semitism doesn't know boundaries. they don't know boundaries outside of Toronto as well. And I didn't read the motion, but I'm hoping that you would include, you know, York Regional Police, Durham Regional Police, the police out in Peel Region, because of course the persons who might take actions that are considered terrorist actions or anti-Semitic hate crimes, they may cross a Toronto Durham region, a Toronto York region, a Toronto Peel region border. So I think other police forces in the GTA need to be a part of this. And I think the model of the auto theft task force is one that could be emulated in this regard. And they moved pretty quickly. Like, we saw a really dramatic drop in the number of auto thefts across the country, although Canada is still a source country for stolen cars. But I think it's important that we prepare for something that may not ever happen, just in case it ever does happen.
Yeah, and things are happening, John. As I said earlier, we have had so many instances of anti-Semitic hate crimes and assaults on schools, assaults on the peace and I think stability of people in seniors' homes and old age homes, and just the sort of attack on, I guess, the fabric of society and how people feel now insecure. Many people in the Jewish community feel insecure in their neighborhoods. Is there something you think this task force could specifically do to address that? Because, yeah, it's a geographic issue. It's in Toronto. But as Rob pointed out, it's a bigger issue than simply our city. But these neighborhoods are particularly affected.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are really two issues. The one issue are the laws, would be the laws themselves, and what needs to be changed so that when people do commit an act, an egregious act, that they're actually punished properly. But I think, you know, so I'm not sure what the task force will do with that. I mean, I think a lot of people already know the answer to that. But I think if someone wants to shoot up a beach or drive a van down a sidewalk, I'm not sure what you're going to do about that in terms of the task force itself. I think what we need is actually political leaders. And I'm talking prime minister, premier, and mayor, who actually are stronger on the issue. I got to say, if you go back to Mayor Chow's speech on the renaming of Dundas Square to Sankofa Square, she was so passionate. You can find it on YouTube. She was so passionate about that. When she talks about anti-Semitism, at least my interpretation is it's very perfunctory. There's no passion. She's checking the boxes. And, you know, when it comes to issues that, her base is not necessarily, and I think it's well documented, favorable to the Jewish community. But when it comes to issues like moving the Science Center, selling land at Ontario Place to the government so they could move ahead with their spa, or even increasing police funding, her activist base has sat on its hands because they've been told to sit on their hands. They have not, in my opinion, got the message from this mayor that this type of behavior is unacceptable, and they're running amok. We have to change hearts, and I'm not sure that a task force is actually going to change hearts.
Okay, Mike, go ahead.
Why are you letting the premier and the prime minister off the hook?
This, no, I'm not, Mike.
Not just
respectfully,
a City of Toronto issue.
No,
you can't just blame
time.
The City of Toronto.
So, Mike, respectfully, counselor, I'm not. If you heard me, I said prime minister, premier, mayor. I'm a counselor. I deal mostly with the mayor, as do you. I listed all other three levels of government, but we also know that primarily the base of the mayor is more hostile to the Jewish community than the base of the premier or base of the base voters of the prime minister. So she's the one that needs to, at least on the city level, take the bull by the horns, in my opinion.
Okay, I want to give the last word to Mike. If I could just intervene, Mike.
The ground here is Toronto.
Okay, Mike,
I just want to. No money from the province, no money from the feds.
Mike, I just want to ask you one last question on this subject. Have you engaged? I know this motion was a motion without notice because these events happened, just within the last week. Have you spoken specifically to the mayor or to any other levels of government, anyone in there, about this motion prior to passage, or do you plan on doing so now that it's done, to get that engagement that John is talking about?
Well, we have been talking to MPs. I've been talking to MPs, MPPs, provincial ministers, federal ministers. I've told them you know, you've got to step up. That it's not good enough just sitting back in Ottawa or Queen's Park and making speeches. They have to put boots on the ground. We have to have CSIS involved because, again, this is not just the mayor of Toronto's issue. And you can blame her for all her shortcomings. And I agree, she's not been up there. But, we, you know, if we keep looking at our feet here in Toronto and not engaging, you know, the senior levels of government, when we're dealing with an internationally inspired terrorist threat here, it's not just a city of Toronto issue. We need help.
Yeah, no, it isn't. And I just want to remind listeners as well, you know, our phones are down. Unfortunately, I can't talk to you directly. But if you do want to engage with the show, you can do so by text 866-740-4740. That's 866-740-4740. You text us. I can read your texts on the air. And I just want to wrap up this part of our show here with a text from Joe, who just echoes that issue, Mike, when he says, did you know Hamas is now in every country in the world and has thousands joining every day? This is partly why this issue needs different levels of government. It needs, you know, it crosses borders. It crosses borders of cities. It is an international concern. And here in Canada, we have to have all actors on the ground. I don't disagree. I do want to get to some of the other issues that City Council did discuss this week. And that, of course, we're going to start with the LRT. Rob is looking at me like, yes, the infamous yes. LRT. Okay, so we finally, it's running, but it's too slow.
It's very slow. And, you know, we had one community activist have a quinceañera for the Eglinton LRT because it was 15 years.
So terrible.
It was kind of humorous, and we all like Mexican food. And then we saw another activist decide to race the LRT to see if he could outrun the darn thing.
On foot?
He ran on foot, and he beat it by 17 or 18 minutes. And so that tells you how slow this thing is going. One of the biggest problems, of course, has been the way in which Metrolinx has been set up and established with the private sector and the non-relationship, perhaps, to the TTC. You know, when I was vice chair of the TTC, we built the completed the Shepherd subway line. Mm-hmm. And we did it ostensibly on time. There were a few delays, but not 10 years of delays and not 5 years of delays. And I said on another show that maybe, just maybe, there's a guy named Rob Ford in heaven looking down saying, I told you so. Mm. And when I said subways, we have a cold climate. We have traffic. We have surface traffic. And subways would avoid all of the challenges that those things present. So, yes, it's good that they're going to look at giving, you know, a signalized priority to the LRT and what have you. But subways would have been a heck of a lot better. And I'm, you know, jokingly saying that Rob Ford is looking down on us saying, I told you so.
I don't disagree that he is on this one. But John, I'm going to ask you, the move that was voted by City Council would give LRT vehicles priority in intersections over left-turning cars. He says that's the way to do this. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think that's a no-brainer. To Rob's point, though, like the wrong decision was made to do these LRTs. Like the Eglinton LRT, the Crosstown, it comes out just at Leslie Street. And from, you know, going east from there, it's going to be a disaster. The left-hand turn is a quick fix. But then the question is, where do they take it from there? How much more priority signaling do you want to give? Because once there's only a certain amount of time, right? You can't build more time. It's finite. So whatever you give them, you're taking away from other vehicles. Right. And, you know, what is the impact on gridlock on those streets? But definitely they have to at least do the left turn, you know, stopping that left turn priority and giving that to the LRT.
Yeah, Councillor Holliday disagreed with that, with even that idea. He said, we don't have enough information and you're going to slow down the cars. I'm going to ask you, Mike, there's an additional part of the mayor's motion, which is to direct the city manager to report back in the first quarter of 2026 with a plan to implement further measures to improve streetcar network speed and reliability. Are you confident that we're going to get some more measures? Is there anything you think that would be another no-brainer perhaps to get streetcars moving faster too?
I'm not confident at all. Basically, this has been a horror show from day one with Metrolinx. Rob knows full well, we've been waiting for the Eglinton line for 15 years, for God's sake. This finch line we've been waiting 4 or 5 years delayed. There's no quick fix, and everybody's a transportation traffic engineer. They've got all these silver bullets. They're gonna no left hand. You know, the fact is, this isn't an Amazon package you buy offline. you know, online. You know, you got to say to the people, listen, give us a couple of months. We got to straighten out these hiccups, because the other thing is the pedestrian safety and vehicle safety. You know, you just can't brush those off, you know, on some computer program in the office. There's going to be twists and turns in this thing. So we just got to say to people, let's be patient. We'll work on it, and we got to fix it. But there's no quick fix here, and everybody's got a quick fix answer. Don't believe it.
Yeah, I don't believe in quick fixes either, but Rob, people will lose patience with the LRT. You know, we already know that the Shepherd Subway, the ridership is not what it's supposed to be. If the LRT ridership is not what it's supposed to be either, we as a city are losing money on this line that costs so much to build and people were waiting for so long. What do we do to rekindle people's faith in Toronto that their transit system is actually working?
Well, I think there's two issues at hand. One is building lines where there isn't yet a demand. And so if you're going to build infrastructure, high-end, high-order rapid transit, and then you better build high density around it. I mean, at the end of the day, that's part of the problem that happened with Shepherd. They built it, and then they downzoned all the property along Shepherd Avenue for a long, long time. And so you can't have it both ways. You can't get a $1 billion piece of infrastructure, but then say we're not going to allow density and we're not going to allow people, builders and landowners to rezone their properties and transform their communities so that there's ridership. The second part of this is, aside from that, is I think there's a lack of leadership. I think the fact that you have, you know, Metrolinx, you have the contractor, you have the TTC, you've got the city councils, you got the province, you got the feds. Everybody has their hand in this pot of stew. And the challenge is they're ruining it because there's nobody in charge of the recipe. And you know, that old saying about many cooks will spoil the broth. And I think that's partly what's happened with transit in Toronto. And partly because we're looking for tripartite funding, right? We're looking for municipal funding, provincial funding, federal funding. Well, guess what? If I'm going to put in $300 million or I'm going to put in $1 billion, I want to have say. And so the challenge is, they're not going to give the money without strings. And when I say strings, I don't mean anything nefarious. I mean, they have their vision for how the line should look. They have MPs and cabinet ministers who represent parts of the line. And they have an idea of how it should look and where it should go. And so, you know, having three levels of government debating something that perhaps one level of government should be determining is the other part of the problem. And then finally, it's just things happen. We have elections. We have different leaders. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was thinking about this today. I remember voting on a new library in my ward, and then I lost the election, and I remember not being invited to cut the ribbon to open the library. Well, no, I don't say it out of personal pain. Right. What I mean is the people who started this project aren't there to end this project.
Correct. There's no accountability.
And there's no accountability. Well, right. It's not my idea. It's something that David Miller voted on and pushed through. And that's part of the problem. But the public has the right to change, you know, governments. And so you have this systemic problem of no accountability because of time.
Right.
Takes too long.
Then you're not going to. Absolutely. Okay. I want to, John, go to something that you were talking about this week, which is a particular bugaboo of mine, e-bikes, e-scooters, actually more than that, but both of them that hop the sidewalk and are just sort of running rampant all over the place. You were calling for stronger measures for police to be able to seize these things. Tell us what happened to that motion this week.
Well, that motion was referred to. There is a micro-strategy committee that's sitting right now and going to come back with recommendations about how we can address that and other issues. And I knew that's where this motion would go, but I wanted to get the conversation going. My concern is that the committee itself is maybe a little timid in their outlook, and I think we need to look at all opportunities. And why I talked about seizing these things is that if you were to drive a motorcycle, first off, you need a license. So it's powered by gas. You need a license. If you were to drive your motorcycle on the sidewalk, dimes for dollars, you're getting a ticket for careless driving. It's $500 to $2,000. It's 6 demerit points. It affects your insurance. It affects your license. So there is a very good opportunity there from an enforcement perspective to encourage good behavior. The problem with all these scooters and e-bikes is that people operating them are outside of the normal levers of society. And what I mean by that is you don't need a license. So, you know, if you get a fine, how do we even compel people to pay it? It's not like it goes against their driver's license. You know, people have these fines that never get paid. So there's no way to really send the message and, you know, I'll say enforce or encourage good behavior. So this is, you know, we have other examples of this where someone gets caught with the roadside for blowing over 80, their car is impounded for a certain number of days, or if they drive 50 kilometers over the speed limit, it's impounded for however many days, I think it's 14. So there are, it doesn't necessarily have to be permanent seizure. It could be temporary seizure. It could be permanent or till a trial. But I think we need to get that conversation going, because I'll say all levels of government, and I mean the city and the province, the ones that are concerned with this or should be, have really just, people have just been wringing their hands, put their head in the sand and done nothing about it.
Yeah, and it is an actual issue that involves more than one level of government. I didn't know this. I knew that e-scooters are illegal to ride in Toronto on the street. But police say they have no authority to seize them because higher levels of government put no restriction on the actual import or sale of them. So it's not criminal to have one. You could theoretically put, you know, scoot around on your driveway or something, and that's fine. But the minute you get on the sidewalk or the street, it's illegal, but they can't do anything about it. You know, Mike, going back to your motion earlier about different levels of government cooperating, how do we get the attention of Queen's Park and other levels of government to deal with this problem?
Well, I think, you know, what I think we got to do is, first of all, start finding the companies that condone and endorse this. I mean, this is their business model.
Yeah, but it's illegal. Like, it's illegal. It's a legal thing. So what do we do? Do we ban the importation?
No, but Uber Eats and Skip the Dishes and all these people, they basically operate their business with these gig workers that constantly use the sidewalks to deliver their goods. So you can't, as John said, you can't find these guys because a lot of them don't have any ID, no licenses. So we know these companies are condoning this. They all know they're all riding the sidewalks to deliver this fast food. So let's find the companies and send them a message that you can't basically use the sidewalks of Toronto to, you know, run your business.
No, oh, that's a very interesting idea. Okay, we'll see if that gets taken up or not, but certainly going where the pockets actually have money would make sense, because then maybe something will get done. Speaking of money, I want to move to one of our other stories, which is this approval of a hike in land transfer taxes for luxury home buyers. Now, luxury is defined as $3 million for a house in Toronto. Now, $3 million is a lot, but we also have one of the highest prices for homes in the country here. So, Rob, you know, looking at this, they're going to raise the city council has Mayor Chow proposed that we raise these property property taxes, but also now raising the luxury taxes. Is this case of soak the rich, really?
It is. Well, yeah. It's better than eat the rich.
We don't want to do that.
But, you know, having been a fan of movies like Soylent Green and all of that.
Dear. Look,
I think this is going to be ill-fated. I think it's going to be a lot like the vacant occupancy tax. It's going to be like the original municipal licensing, municipal land transfer tax. So back in the day when they introduced the land transfer tax, the maximum, you could buy a home for under $400,000 and it didn't apply. So what happened is, people, because I have good friends in real estate, they said everyone avoided the homes listed for $405,000 and $410,000, and they bid up all the $300,000 homes. So in order to avoid the $5,000 or $6,000 additional land transfer tax, they overpaid for a home listed at $350,000, and they bid $370,000 and $380,000. Okay. They paid a higher price. They didn't pay the tax, but they paid a higher price. So this is going to have a lot of inflationary pressure on every house that's under $3 million. It's going to have the impact of driving buyers to homes that are under $3 million. And so those $1.5 million, $2 million homes are going to get bid up, and this is going to make housing even less affordable in Toronto. It may very well raise revenue for the $3 million gang, but for the folks like me who are in a different sort of income bracket and opportunity to purchase a home, it's going to make housing very, very difficult for them to acquire, because it's going to, in a way, raise all boats. You know, that tide that raises all boats. In this particular case, it's going to do it, but not in a good way.
Yeah, that's a problem. John, you also pointed out another problem, which is, and you asked the mayor about this, are wealthy people simply going to move out of the city to places like Aurora or others?
Well, exactly. There are two issues. One, obviously, in this budget season, we can see this is an indication the mayor is scrounging for money. But, you know, people with money have the opportunity to move around. That's the thing that wealth gives you. It gives you freedom. And, you know, I don't want to dissuade wealthy people from coming here. I want successful people coming to Toronto, bringing jobs, bringing their ingenuity and their philanthropy. You know, look around downtown at all the hospital wings that are built by people with a lot of money. So those people can also move to Aurora, as I made the point at council, where they actually keep the pools open in a heat wave and remove snow after a snowstorm.
Okay, and last word will be to you on this, Mike. You know, this eat the rich, soak the rich, tax the rich, I don't know what we're going to call it, but going after people with these homes, what kind of message does that send about Toronto? And will it also maybe, you know, have an effect on the housing market? People just won't sell or buy more because they'll be hit with these taxes.
Well, first of all, the taxes, residential taxes in Aurora are higher than they are in Toronto.
Ah.
And so I don't think they'd be moving there to get cheaper taxes.
Don't let facts get in the way, Michael. A good argument.
They're higher in Whitby, too. I used to live there, but I digress. Go on.
Exactly. We've got the lowest residential tax rate. But, you know, our home prices are high and pay. So this is like whack-a-mole. You know, the city is desperate to try and keep property taxes down for the average homeowners across the board. So we keep getting downloaded with asylum seekers, refugee claimants. Now we're in the housing business. We need more money for policing. We need more money for all these social services. And so, and meanwhile, the feds in the province, they get 90% of all the taxes paid in Toronto. And so, you know, you can't have it both ways. So therefore, yeah, we're scrambling to find money. And so the mayor is trying to find some money here. Is it fair? I don't think so. But on the other hand, what else are you going to do? What other taxes are you going to raise? You know, where are you going to find revenues, you know, when you don't have any other sources of revenue?
Yeah.
You know, so therefore we're stuck.
That's a whole, you know, I'd love to have that debate and discussion with you, all of three of you, but we're out of time. You know, other forms of taxes like New York has a sales tax. Oh, dear. That would get people, I'm sure, texting in. Okay. But we are out of time here for this segment. I want to thank you so much for tuning into The Town, Rob Davis, John Burnside, and Mike Cole. We will be back after this short break with discussion of federal politics. So stick around.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Tasha Kiridan.
Hello, we are back, and we're going to switch our focus now to federal politics and talk about the state of the Conservative Party. It's been a couple of floor crossings that have bolstered the ranks of the Liberals to the point where they are one short of a majority. And this has caused some chatter about the leadership of Pierre Poilievre, Conservative leader. Are people leaving his ship because they don't like the management style, because they think they'll have a better chance of being reelected with the Liberals? Or, you know, what is actually going on here? And this could this portend problems for him at his leadership review in January, or within caucus, who also have the potential power to remove him if they feel they would want to do so, like they did with Aaron O'Toole a couple of years ago. I'm going to ask you to text in, because this is a, you know, everyone's got their favorite horse to bet on here. If the Conservatives did have a leadership race next year, if Pierre Poilievre were to no longer be leader, who would you put in his place? text us, 866-740-4740. That's 866-740-4740. Who do you think would be a potential next leader of the Federal Conservative Party? To talk about that and what's going on with the party right now, I'm joined by someone who knows a lot about it. He's been around for decades. John McEtishan is a conservative activist, political consultant, and president of Bradgate Research Group. Hi, John. And John is supposed to be on our Google Meets. I am seeing that he is going to be joining in a second. And there you are. Fantastic.
All right.
Yes. Well, you know, we've had some technical issues here, but I'm really glad to be talking to you today about this. I actually talked to you earlier this week. I wrote a piece in the National Post, shameless plug here, about this topic, and you gave me some really good insights. So share them with our listeners now. First of all, do you think that Pierre Poilievre's leadership is in trouble?
It's always in trouble when you're not the prime minister. But it becomes a question of two things. Like, no one would have predicted that the way our last prime minister went out the door was by a caucus revolt.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would have ever predicted that. And he was the prime minister for almost 10 years. So it really comes down to, right now for Pierre, does his future look like he's going to win? And there's nothing like power to have everybody on your side and then, you know, and cheerleading you. Or is there a point in time when people start to lose faith because the polling isn't what they think it should be? Or, and that pertains to January when the delegates, 3,000 roughly, will be gathering from conservative ranks across the country in Calgary. And to have a specific vote on do we or do we not have a leadership process. And I think Pierre will pass that by 80%. Again, people who are happy, people who are staffers have been told they better go and vote for the leader, caucus members, etc. They're working hard, they're whipping it, they're doing what leaders should do, which is protect themselves. But the bigger wild card is a few months, I believe, later when the Reform Act is in play, famously used for the first time by after every election. Each party gets to decide whether or not they want to adopt three key tools in that piece of legislation, one of which is the ability to dump the leader at any given time if a certain number of MPs sign a letter saying we want a secret ballot vote on this. And on the day that Erin O'Toole lost that vote in his situation, his people swore they had 75%. The people who wanted him gone swore they had 75%. And the leader didn't see it coming.
Right.
So there's a real potential for the future. And I think that'll most likely happen if things don't get a lot better for Pierre. I think among the general populace, and I think that's a very real possibility in the spring or fall.
Is it the populace, though, or is it the seat count? Because right now the Conservatives are at 41%. Pierre's leadership is lower. His rankings are consistently lower than Mark Carney's. His approval ratings as a potential prime minister. But the party is polling at 41%. But if Mark Carney does convince one or two more conservatives or others to cross the floor and give him a majority, would that be a potential tipping point for caucus to say, okay, it's time for someone else?
Yeah, potentially, because what it would also do is signal to the Liberals that nobody's going to really challenge them for 2 years and they can run the mandate. But, I think Carney will have a majority before the House resumes at the end of January.
Mm-hmm.
I think he'll, somebody will be convinced to retire, to vacate, whatever. I mean, there's lots of things that aren't talked about. Floor crossing, in one way, is honorable, and on the other hand, some people hate it. But, if you just retire and then 6 months later get a government appointment to a trade mission or some huge board, there's lots of ways of buying people off without ever making it public.
Hmm.
Even if it's benign,
and it's something as subtle as, hey, we'll make sure you land up at a law firm as an advisor, whatever that's supposed to mean, right? So, you know, he'll get the majority. And then the question is, how grumpy are conservatives then? And something I think has been missing from the public debate. Greens, people that run for the Green Party, the NDP and the Bloc, they have no expectation of forming government. But the Liberals and conservatives, they don't run to be backbenchers. They don't run to be opposition backbenchers. They run because they believe they can form a government and they want to get some policy through and they aspire to cabinet. So, you know, anybody watches Question Period, you'll see three rows of people behind Pierre who will only get grumpier every day they're in opposition, but even worse if the majority is secured.
Okay, let's talk about the people now. Some people, if there are any people that could potentially fill Pierre Poilievre's shoes if there was a leadership. I just want to read one text by Debbie first. Fail to plan to fail. I guess that means that the conservatives better, these people better start planning too if they're interested in filling the shoes of the leader if they get empty. If you want to text us, by the way, 866-740-4740 is the text to do. Let's start now with some of these contenders potentially. And, you know, I canvassed a bunch of conservative insiders, including yourself on this. And one of the names in caucus that came up was Jamil Giovanni. So can you tell us a bit about Jamil Giovanni? And is he a potential leader for the party sometime down the road?
Well, what I'm going to do is say, if anybody really wants to delve into this, they need to look at the last three conservative leaderships. You know, post-Harper, when Harper retired, the A-team of people that everybody expected to run, none of them ran. And what we had was 13 people, at one point 15 people, running for the leadership that were B, C, D players. Then the party tightened the rules. And you had, again, a lesser, you know, not the A-list running the next time. And then last time, again. So, you know, who ran? You know, with all due respect to the great people that run for the leadership of the party, they weren't any players in a traditional political sense. So if Pierre were to leave one way or another, the race to replace him is wide open. And anybody, Jamil, another backbencher, someone from Ontario who hasn't spent a day in Ottawa, could all run and be top tier contenders because it's all relative to who else is in the race.
Well, that is true. And in terms of other people from Ontario who might be in the race, names that were given to me included Mark Mulroney and Doug Ford. Your thoughts on those two?
I've never met Mr. Mulroney, but, you know, he certainly has a legion of fans. And certainly, you know, he seemed to have the economic chops to do a great job. But, you know, that's also what people thought of. You know, Mark Carney's kind of hurt international bankers now because he was touted as being the guy that would save our national economy. And he doesn't seem to be doing that in the slightest. So I can't really say much about him except that he comes from a storied political family. He certainly would be connected. Certainly based on his bio, he'd be able to raise the money. People forget that too. You may like that people are talking about you running for leader, but you have to be able to raise millions of dollars in a mm-hmm. short period of time for your own campaign. And that narrows the list pretty considerably too. Doug Ford checks all the boxes except for French. Now, some people say, yeah, but we're not going to win seats in Quebec anyway. And Ontario's got over 120 seats. If you're picking a province you want to dominate, wouldn't it be Ontario? We're kind of maxed out in Alberta. So, you know, they're victims of their own success. Where the Conservatives need to pick up a lot of seats and win is in Ontario.
That's true.
So, okay. You mentioned who's more logical than Doug Ford?
Yeah, you mentioned Alberta, and I want to ask your last thoughts on the last person that was mentioned to me, which is Jason Kenney. Now, I asked Jason directly, and he said no. a couple months ago. And then someone, after I wrote my article, emailed me and said, hey, I talked to him 3 weeks ago, and he said he didn't rule it out. So what are your thoughts on him?
Jason's an interesting guy. Like Jean Charest, in his day, they left the scene in Ottawa to go to their respective provinces and Quebec and Alberta in order to save the country, to unite the country, to represent the Commonwealth as opposed to an individual province. And Jason had some success until he didn't. Wasn't he ultimately run out of Alberta?
Well, his party did turn on him, absolutely. And that was, and ironically, during the pandemic, when Alberta had the loosest restrictions in the country, people were the least satisfied in Alberta with their government of anyone across the country. They wanted even fewer. And it seemed to me he had a bit of trouble juggling that, right?
Right. So I would say expect Albertans to not support their own and be grumpy with Jason.
Hmm.
And again, like Doug Ford, Jason's single biggest strength, and I think this happened during his time with Harper, before they became government, Jason was like the original poster boy for outreach, which is code language among political parties for go get the ethnic vote and the various groups. Jason was the guy at every temple, church, synagogue, any gathering of five people or more, you would expect to find Jason there. And liberals had been at those meetings forever, and he was the guy, like an evangelical person out there, bringing the word of the conservatism to these different groups and say, hey, you have another choice. So those ties don't go away. You don't do that for 20 years across the country. Meet all those leaders, know them by name, know them by sight, and them know you and think you're a brother, in Jason's case, without that being, like, I would say he's probably one of three top people in the country among conservatives who would have that massive ability to put together that kind of national organization very, very quickly.
All right. Well, we will be watching this year, whatever happens to the party, and I'm sure we will talk again. John McTishan, want to thank you so much. John McTishan is a conservative activist and political consultant and president of Bradgate Research Group. When we come back after this short break, we're going to talk about the Thorncliffe Park fire. Fire Chief Jim Jessup is going to tell us how it was finally brought under control and what we can do maybe differently or learn from this terrible fire that has affected so many of our fellow Torontonians.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Tasha Kiridan.
Welcome back. It's been called the most complex fire in Toronto history. The blaze broke out at 11 Thorncliffe Park Drive and 21 Overly Boulevard on November 27th, and it took over 2 weeks to put it out. Officials finally announced this Monday it had been extinguished, but the connected buildings and the 408 units that were evacuated last month will have to be assessed for damage now before people can go back, and no one knows how long that will take. But we have learned a lot about this fire and how to fight similar fires going forward. And to talk about all this and take us through exactly what happened and why it took so long to contain this blaze, we're joined by Fire Chief Jim Jessup. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
I can hear you very well. And I'd like to know, because I was reading about this and sort of keeping tabs on the story and thinking, the fire's still burning. The fire is still burning. How did this fire start, if you know that now? And how did you get it finally? Like, why did it take so long to get it under control?
No, and thank you for having me. So I'll start with the first question. So the investigation into the origin, cause, and circumstances of this fire is still being completed with Toronto Fire Service and the Toronto Police Service. So unfortunately, I won't be able to discuss or comment anything related to the cause, origin, or circumstances that led to this unprecedented deployment of resources and displacement of people. Certainly, what I do want to start by saying is thanking the residents for their patience, for their understanding, and for their resilience. the being displaced for that period of time, especially at this time of year, I cannot imagine the stress that put on residents, the anxiety and the unknown, and certainly on behalf of Toronto Fire Service and the entire city of Toronto, that really did, galvanize together for a one city of Toronto response. I do want to acknowledge and thank, all of those that were displaced for their understanding and their patience and most importantly, their resilience. So in terms of what made it so difficult, the city of Toronto has never seen a fire or experienced a fire like this. And quite frankly, what happened was a second building was built beside 11 Thorncliffe. So 21 Overlea was constructed beside 11 Thorncliffe. And when you construct buildings beside each other, you always leave what they call an expansion joint. So the buildings act independently. And in between the expansion joint, between the two buildings, at the time of construction, this combustible particle board was placed between the two buildings, so the concrete of each building didn't touch each other. The challenge that posed for us was we had, when the fire started, Toronto Fire Service had less than 2 inches to work between the two buildings to try to extinguish this slow-burning, smoldering fire. And again, the area that my staff were dealing with was 12 stories high and 15 meters horizontal. So over 6,000 square feet of combustible particle board, was slowly smoldering between two buildings. And because of the lack of space, we literally had no eyes on it and could not see what we were fighting. So we were constantly chasing the fire, doing our best, trying to understand, where the fire was burning, and as importantly, trying to come up with different ways to put it out.
Yeah, you compared it to a slow-burning cigar that just kept going.
Correct.
And going. 12 stories is very, very tall. Did you have the equipment to battle this to that height? Like, how did you physically get up there and get to all the places where this thing was smoldering?
No, so Toronto Fire Service, is certainly blessed in terms of resources and support from City Council and the senior leadership team. And, as the largest service in the country and the most vertical city in North America, it was not the apparatus, the equipment, or even the human resources that posed the challenge. What it was we had no way to access the fire. Mm. We could not see the fire. And the fact that it was a smoldering fire, it was not even giving off enough heat for our thermal imaging cameras to detect. And, second or third day into the fire, we brought in a team of multidisciplinary engineers from across the fire, from across Toronto Fire, Toronto Building, and even the building's owners sent in their own engineers. And for the first time, in the history of our service, we literally had a second command post set up where the engineers were coming up with new ideas and new suggestions on how to try to extinguish this slow-burning, smoldering fire. And we tried everything from carbon dioxide and dry ice to displace the oxygen, to helium to displace the oxygen. And finally, we ended up using large volumes of high-pressure foam through Tower 1, our large Bronto Tower. And after we ended up drilling holes and cutting access holes through a number of units, we finally were able to confirm that the foam was actually penetrating from the top all the way down to the bottom. After several applications and several periods of monitoring for smoke and carbon monoxide, after all of that incredible effort by my staff, we were finally able to conclude and confirm the fire was extinguished.
Was there ever a danger that the fire would consume the buildings, or did the concrete kind of contain it in that space?
No. As I said, this fire was literally a smoldering, just imagine a smoldering cigar. Mm-hmm. What it did do was produce large amounts of carbon monoxide and white wispy smoke that was accessing and getting and permeating through all different parts of both buildings through ventilation shafts and other openings. So there was certainly no danger in terms of structural damage because of the fire, because There were no flames. It was a slow smoldering burning fire that produced, as I said, lethal amounts in the initial stages of carbon monoxide, which is why we had to evacuate both buildings and smoke. So, you know, the fire is now completely extinguished. We have turned the building back to the owners. They are now responsible for having their third-party engineers do, you know, life safety assessments, building assessments, to the satisfaction of Toronto Building, that it is safe for them to start slowly reoccupying in the building.
So what lessons have we learned from this, I mean, this incredible experience? And congratulations, by the way, on battling this successfully. It sounds like it was a bit of a war zone.
Well, you know, it's funny. I've been asked a number of times as we come to the end of the year, you know, the end of my first year as chief, you know, what makes me proud, or what have I thought of? And I will say this, as I said, you know, we want to completely acknowledge the resilience and the understanding and the patience of the residents. But, you know, our staff never quit. The Toronto Fire Service, you know, was on scene 24 hours a day, working up on that roof through some pretty horrible conditions. And my team never quit. And, you know, it was a testament to their resilience and their innovation and their ingenuity. You know, and a combination of the firefighters and the engineers and really being willing to try something new, because again, we along with no other service that we could find, has ever experienced a fire like this. So, you know, as part of the investigation, we'll find out, you know, what happened and why, and we will release that information, as soon as the investigation is completed. And Toronto Fire Service, as we do with all major incidents, will be doing an after action review. And there's no doubt there will be lessons learned, you know, for us, in the unlikely event we have a similar incident like this in the future. But it certainly is a unique experience, and certainly something that, you know, we'll look back on. And again, just, you know, be very proud of the work that my people did. And again, you know, very thankful for the patience and understanding of the community and the residents that were impacted.
Yeah. And we hope it does not happen again. You know, people probably looking at their buildings now, if they're contiguous with another building, and thinking, oh boy, could this happen here? But I want to turn our focus in the last minute here to the people who've been displaced, because as you said, there's 239 people, 119 households. They've been staying in hotel rooms. Support's coming from the Canadian Red Cross. And I'm sure if our listeners are listening, if you want to donate, you can connect with the Red Cross to do so, to help these families at a very difficult time, because it is the holiday season. It is winter. You know, I cast my mind back to the Jamestown fire, and that impacted people also in a winter. Very difficult. So what's happening to those folks right now?
Well, so right now, they are working with their own insurance companies, and they are working with the condominium boards and owners of both properties. So, you know, the City of Toronto took a Team Toronto approach when this happened. It was not just Toronto Fire, you know, the Toronto Police Service, the Toronto Paramedic Service, Toronto Emergency Management, the TTC, numerous city divisions banded together and you know, completely supported all of those that were displaced over the, you know, up to the 14-day period that our policy allows for. So at this point, you know, they are encouraged to work with their insurance companies. You know, the rephased occupancy is now really in the arms of the building owners and their engineers, satisfactory to the reports submitted to the Toronto Building Department. But at this point, really, it is up to the individual owners and their insurance companies, you know, to look at their individual policies and make sure that they have what they need to get back in.
Okay, well, we do hope that they get back in as soon as possible and everyone stays safe and does have a happy holiday season. I want to thank you so much, Fire Chief Jim Jessup, for walking us through Toronto's worst, I guess, or most complex, I would say most complex fire in history. Thank you for your time today. And that is all the time we have. I will be vacating the chair. Libby is back tomorrow. Wishing all you and your loved ones as well a happy holiday season until we talk again on Fight Back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.